Today's episode of Hollywood How Did You Get Here is brought to you by G Technologies, a leading storage solution brand for the entertainment industry. Stay tuned for a special offer from G Technology later on in the show. I'd also like to give a special thanks to our lighting sponsor, LEDGO Technologies, for supporting our show. On today's show, we sit down with cinematographer Polly Morgan, ASC-BSC. Polly's a rising star in the film industry and listed by Variety Magazine as one of the top 10 cinematographers to watch. Polly's been a creative force behind TV shows like Legion and Strange Angel, as well as theatrical releases like Lucy in the Sky with Natalie Portman and her newest film, A Quiet Place 2, from director John Krasinski. Polly was gracious enough to allow me to Skype into her living room, so the audio quality may have suffered a little, but her charming accent still shines through. So settle in, find a comfortable chair, and we'll be right back with cinematographer Polly Morgan. All right, so welcome to the show, Polly Morgan, ASC-BSC. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having me, Tim. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, it's good to see you. All right, so the show is called Hollywood, How Did You Get Here? So I'm going to ask you, tell me a little bit about the early days and how you chose to become a cinematographer.
So I was really fortunate in that I grew up loving movies. And then when I was a teenager, a feature film crew actually got in contact with my dad and asked if they could come and use our farmhouse for their base camp. So at a young age, I was exposed to a film crew with all the gear and the camera and the cranes. And, you know, it just really ignited my passion and, you know, just really encouraged me to pursue it as a career.
How old?
I think I was 13 or maybe 14.
Do you remember the first thing you shot?
Yes, the first thing I shot, so when I was a PA, basically, just to fill you in on what happened was, so when I was 13 and 14, I was exposed to this film crew. And then I was trying to find a university degree that would kind of do some sort of practical filmmaking so that I was covered in case my filmmaking career didn't work out. And I went up to the University of Leeds in Yorkshire, and I did a broadcasting course that was co-run by the BBC. And we got some like sort of on-camera training with BBC directors, both in single camera and multi-camera. So that was kind of the first time that I was actually able to get my hands on a camera, especially back then, because, you know, video cameras and stuff were kind of hard to come by. And then when I graduated from that degree, I went down to London and I worked for Ridley Scott's company, his commercial production company called RSA in Soho, as an in-house PA, or as they call them in London, a runner. And while I was a runner, I sort of, you know, got into cahoots with other runners, and we started making music videos and no budget commercials and short films.
Do you have formal filmmaking training?
Well, I wouldn't really call it formal filmmaking training, but, you know, it was just a way for me to be able to get my hands on a camera, and it was very sparse. And, you know, we also learned to edit video, sort of online editing through Premiere had just become available. But my formal training really happened at AFI. Which is the American Film Institute here in Los Angeles, which I went to after working as a runner for 2 years and then as a camera assistant for 5 years in England.
That sounds like to go from a runner to AFI is a big, that doesn't typically happen, does it? I mean, don't AFI students usually have a body of work before they even get to AFI?
Yeah, you have to apply to go to AFI with a showreel. And so what I was doing is I worked for 2 years as a runner, you know, and eventually after working in-house for the company, they would start sending me out to set. And then when I was on set, I would basically hang out with the camera crew and bring them lots of tea and basically ask them lots of questions. And soon the cameramen that were on the commercials that I was running on, they said, oh, you know, do you want to come out and be our camera trainee? And that's the wonderful thing about being a sort of enthusiastic young filmmaker in the UK is that there's no red tape or unions to get onto a set with, you know, like if I wanted to go and work for free as a camera trainee, I could just go out. There wasn't any legal issues with unions or liability. So it was really fantastic. So I worked to earn money as a runner. And then whenever I could, I would go work for free as a camera trainee. And I started to learn the craft of being a camera loader. And then I started getting hired as a second AC or clapper loader, as they're called in the UK. And I was a clapper loader for 5 years. And so while I was earning money as a clapper loader, I was shooting short films that I would write and direct, short films that I would find online. I would basically shoot anything that anybody would let me shoot. And then I cut together that material, and that was the application that I made to AFI to get in.
So I read something online, and I didn't know this to be true. And you and I have known each other for 10 years probably now.
Yeah.
Are you really the only one to be both ASC and BSC?
Currently, yes. But let's hope that will change soon.
It's a glass ceiling. I'm glad you broke, but I'm shocked. I really am. How is that possible in 2020 that you're the only woman that's ASC and BSC? It's not right.
Right. Well, in 2017, when I got asked to join the BSC, I think I was the fourth woman to be a member, because Sue Gibson, sadly, had recently passed away. So there were five, and then there were four of us. And I don't know how many women there are in the ASC now, but in 2018, there weren't as many as there are now. So, you know, I think the numbers are growing considerably. I think there's definitely an active desire to, you know, balance them out and make everything equal. But especially in the UK, it was a slower process for them to adopt than it was over here.
Yeah. Well, it's time to, I don't know, I think we're moving in the right direction. 10 years ago.
We are.
I mean, we really are. And it's, in all fairness, everything has seemed to be going, it happened too slow. But it's happening, and you have female cinematographers like yourself, and so many like Rachel Morrison's, and there's just so many great. It can't be denied anymore. So you never probably don't ever have to justify your gender any longer. You just have to show the work.
Sure. No, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, sadly, historically, we all know that the film business has been, you know, predominantly white and male. And those are the stories that we all grew up seeing. And now, you know, the people that work in the business really are actively encouraging us to seek out a diverse set of voices. You know, we want to hear from women and men and different people of color and different people of sexual orientation. You know, like, that's what makes it exciting. You know, filmmaking is the most accessible art form of this century. And so we need it to be diverse, because we need it to be representative of all the people out there.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's jump to 2011. And because it's us, I'm going to bring up a film called Mobius.
Okay, yes. Why would you bring that up?
Because I hired a woman for that shoot. That's where we met.
Yes.
And it sort of started this interesting revolution. I really think it started this interesting revolution in a bit of democratization. It was when the 5D Mark, no, it wasn't even the 5Ds, it was when the Canon C300 came out, and you were picked to shoot one of the very first films for it. How much has changed since then, do you think? I mean, there's 25 more cameras out there than there were before, and have budgets changed, have approach changed? How do you decide what camera now?
I mean, if I'm really honest, and I think camera manufacturers will not be pleased to hear this, but I think that technology has moved forward so far that most camera manufacturers, you know, you can use a camera and make an exceptional image, and you wouldn't necessarily be able to tell what camera was being used because their technical capabilities are exceptional. I think, you know, recently we've moved into large format and therefore large format lenses, you know, with the drive to shoot higher and higher resolution. And then the higher resolution just ends up calling for a larger field of view. And so now we've got a slightly different image than we all grew up watching, which is the 35 mil sensor. Now we have these larger format sensors, which I think is an exciting new visual tool. But technically, you know, if I start thinking about cameras that perform really well in low light, whether that's, you know, Alexas, the Venice, the DXL, Red cameras, you know, like all these professional cameras all provide exceptional images, you know, like it's really the lenses, I think, that DPs are now using in order to differentiate their work and give it a certain look. But, you know, we're shooting high resolution, we're shooting in, you know, lower and lower light levels. And the work that's being produced is gorgeous. You know, I was just looking at the recent Emmy nominations, and the work out there is just so beautiful. And often, you know, sort of quite moody. You know, I think that thing with newer cameras, and you sort of like reference back to older movies and stuff, everything is, you know, much lower light levels than it was in the past, where everyone had to like flood the film stock with light in order to get an exposure. Now we're all sort of playing down in the bottom of the curve, and really creating such striking atmospheres, I think.
So you work in traditional theatrical as well as television.
Yes.
What's the, like, I really loved Lucy in the Sky, the look of it specifically.
Thank you.
It was, I watched everything you've ever shot, I think, at least in the last 10 years, and I wouldn't have picked that out as yours exactly. It felt like you were really stretching and going in a different direction. Am I wrong on that, or was there some intentional?
No, I don't think you're wrong. I mean, I think that, you know, I would love to be a DP that, although maybe I have a signature style, you know, like my work is going to change and morph depending on the story that I'm telling. And I think, you know, Lucy in the Sky was my first studio movie. It was the biggest budget movie I've ever done. And that sort of brings with it, you know, more toys to play with and different choices of equipment, different numbers of crew to support you. So, you know, I think coming from the independent world where, you know, you're sort of like battling with short shooting schedule and inexperienced crew and, you know, maybe not necessarily the gear that you would choose if you had more money, you know, like that kind of affects the look a little bit. Whereas you're suddenly moving into much bigger budget stuff, and the directors that you're now working with, they have a better understanding of how the visuals can move the story forward and sort of what they want to do with the camera. And, you know, I think you have room to move the camera a lot more. And, you know, especially with Noah Hawley that directed that movie, like he is very much a lover of the visuals. And so we really pushed the boat in that movie, like with lenses, camera and movement.
Yeah, it was really good. I mean, I didn't see it in a theater, and I don't know why, but
not many people did.
No? Oh, well, it's still a great movie.
Yeah.
So, but I would see it in a theater if we ever get to go to a theater again.
Yeah.
So I honestly felt the whole, and my point was kind of, I think that's the kind of movie that should have been seen in a theater.
Yeah.
So you also shot a lot of episodes of Legion,
mm-hmm.
and then Strange Angel. You did a couple of those as well. But
yeah.
Those are not for theaters. How do you shift gears, especially in a period piece like Strange Angel, which I think a period piece probably communicates better on a bigger screen? Maybe I'm wrong, but how do you sort of shift gears, or is that all up to set decorators and you just treat it like anything else?
I mean, I do think that sort of like the screen that you're shooting for comes into some choices that you'll make on set. You know, I think, for example, if you do an extreme wide shot and your characters are, you know, little tiny people on the frame, I think you can get away with that more on a bigger screen than you can maybe on the smaller screen. And sort of like how close do you want your close-ups to be, or how many close-ups you want to employ, those kind of considerations, like framing choices, kind of come into consideration depending on if you think most people are going to see your work on the big screen or on the small screen. But what's interesting now, and especially with the pandemic, is, you know, really we have to think how many people are going to see the movie in the theater on a 40-foot screen, how many people are going to watch it at home on their beautiful TVs, and how many people now are watching these movies on their iPhones or their iPads on a train on the way to work. You know, so it's very interesting to like sort of think about how people are consuming the work that you produce.
Right. So you just finished, well, not just finished, but you've got the last big film for you is Quiet Place 2.
Yes.
Which is not out yet, September-ish, depending on what happens in the world.
Let's hope.
So there's two questions. One is, you're taking over a film which was huge to do the second one, and you're with the DP on the first one. So how is the challenge of create? Do you create a look? Do you copy a look? Do you care what the first one looked like, or you do your own way? I mean, I haven't seen it yet either, but.
Well, it's really interesting because it did come into consideration when I was thinking about doing the film, whether I should take it or not, the fact that it was a sequel, which wasn't that appealing to me at the time. I was kind of like, I don't know if I want to do number two, you know, I want to do number one. But it was such a good film, and the script for the second one was so beautifully written. And I really, you know, responded to it strongly. So, you know, and then I had a great conversation with the director. So, you know, I definitely referenced the first one a lot. And in my mind, because the second one picks up from when the first one left off, I really wanted people to be able to go to the theater and watch a double bill and be able to roll seamlessly from the first movie to the second. And I remember having really long conversations with John, the director, because the first movie, they ended it and they shot an exterior in the day, but they graded it to be dusk. And even when I watched the first movie, I didn't really think of it as being dusk. It just had a sort of unique look to it. But he really, you know, he wanted to shoot this second one starting at dusk. So I definitely made sure that the work at the farmhouse with the family, you know, I really wanted that to be seamless because I really imagined people watching them back to back. And then, of course, you know, the family leave the farmhouse and they venture off into a more expansive world. And I think that world just takes on a look and feel of its own. And also, I think no matter how much of Charlotta's work that I referenced, which I thought was exceptional, I am just my own, you know, artist. Like I see the world in my own unique way, and I have my own unique instincts. And so, you know, when you're sort of working under pressure and you're making choices on the fly, you just automatically go to your own choices. So I definitely had a lot of respect for the way the first one looked, and I wanted to continue it on, so it felt seamless. Yeah.
And right now we're thinking maybe September.
Yes, last I heard was September the 4th. And you know, I get asked all the time, maybe, you know, will the movie be released streaming instead of theatrical because of the pandemic? But honestly, I think like the first movie, this is a movie that you want to sit in a dark room with a group of people and share the experience, because it's full of jumps, it's full of emotion, it's really, it takes you on a very emotive ride, and I think that's best, a shared experience.
Yeah, I agree. That was sort of my second question is, what a shame if it doesn't actually show up in a big dark theater.
Yeah.
Which dark theaters might be even scarier by September, who knows? So every time somebody sneezes, we'll all jump.
Oh my gosh. I mean, I think it will, just because, you know, John, he really, you know, we fought to shoot that on 35mm film. You know, he really believes in that whole traditional experience of filming and the sort of cinematic experience. So I really hope that you do get to see it in a theater.
How was the film experience for you? How many film projects have you shot?
I mean, honestly, it was very nerve-wracking to me. The last time I exposed film was when I had just left film school, and Michael Goy, ASC, gave me a job shooting additional photography for him on the second season of American Horror Story. And I was scared to death then, and nothing really had changed over the last, I don't know, 8 years or something. But, you know, it's amazing how familiar you get when you're doing it all the time. And I did a lot of camera tests. I did, you know, I tested various stocks. I pushed them. I underexposed them. I overexposed them. And I really, you know, was paying close attention to the dailies and my exposure, just to make sure that everything was good. But it was a daunting process, having, you know, just relied on digital cameras and monitoring and the waveform and having a DIT. You know, you get very comfortable in that world. But it was also very freeing, because instead of running backwards and forward to a tent, you know, I'm just right there with an iPad looking at a very blurry image that you can't really tell what's going on. And I just had my light meter, and I was next to the director, and I was next to the actors and the operators, and I felt very much part of the process, which was fantastic.
Going back to your early days again for 1 second.
Yeah.
The gist of what I got out of that was you just kept working, that your education was just keep working and shooting. Your formal education came at AFI, but everything else was pick up a camera. So there will be, hopefully, there's people listening out there that are aspiring to do what you did. Any advice, any suggestions for them?
So, you know, I was so fortunate in the fact that that film crew came to our farmhouse, because it's so difficult for young people all around the world to have a dream of working in a certain career and having absolutely no idea how to get there. You know, and especially back then, whatever year that was, you know, it was pre-internet. It was very difficult for anybody to sort of get their foot in the door in the film business. And I think, you know, it's important now to, you know, give people encouragement. And hopefully there's more and more workshops as filmmaking has become more available to people as a career choice. But for me, you know, I was so lucky to have that experience. And I also, when I was younger and still do, suffer from dyslexia. And when I was at school, my teachers told me that I should leave school and I should be a secretary, or I should be a work in hotel management. And they called my mother in, and they encouraged me to go do something vocational. And I think luckily for me, the kind of person that I am, is that made me all the more determined to prove them wrong. And I had this dream in my mind of what I wanted to do, and nothing would shake me from my path. So I think that stubbornness or tenacity or whatever it is the thing that's really got me where I am today, in that there was no veering from the path. And I think that I can't tell you how many times my family would say to me, why don't you think about doing something else? Like, we don't really know what it is that a cinematographer does, and you haven't had any money for your whole life, you know? And I would just never give up. I think that is the thing about filmmaking, is it's difficult. It's competitive. There's lots of barriers to entry for many people out there. And if you really want to do it, you have to figure out a way. And you just have to keep shooting. And for me, I was not in any way shy of trying to get people to hire me to shoot. I would shoot anything. I didn't care what it was. And that's the thing. It just, every time I picked up a camera, I learned something else. I met somebody else. And all those experience kind of, like, you know, has led me to where I am today.
Yeah, on your credits, there was one title that I just loved from one show way back. This is 2004, and you were a camera assistant on an episode called Car Boot and Pigeon Shit. I don't know if you even remember that. You have that's on your IMDb.
Oh, God.
A 2014 episode as an assistant camera operator on Car Boot and Pigeon Shit. So, yeah, shoot everything you can shoot. It's a great title. Good name for a rock band.
Yeah, I met this DP once that said to me that he would only shoot things that once they were on his IMBD that he would be proud of. And I was like, you know what? I just wasn't you know, I wasn't proud. I just had to just shoot whatever I could, you know.
Oh, I don't know what it looks like. I don't even know what it looks like. I just love the title.
Yeah, yeah. No, exactly. I mean, I can't even remember what that is.
2004, who cares?
Who cares?
All right, so we are going to take a little bit of a break here, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to go to the section called Craft, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. We have already a little bit, but about the tools that you need for your trade. So we'll be back in just a minute.
This week's episode of Hollywood, How Did You Get Here? Is brought to you by G Technology. Since their inception in 2004, G Technology has offered affordable, reliable, high-performance hard drives. This week, in collaboration with G Technology, we're offering listeners of this podcast 10% off G Technology drives when you shop at filmtools.com. All you have to do is enter code Hollywood when you purchase a G Technology drive on filmtools.com. That's HOLLYWOOD to get 10% off G Technology drives from Film Tools. So if you're in the market for some new storage, make sure to head over to Film Tools and use code Hollywood at checkout to get 10% off your next G Technology drive purchase. And now back to the show.
All right, we are back, and we're here with Polly Morgan, and we're going to talk a little bit about the craft of filmmaking. I know we've done a lot of that because that's what Polly's all about, but given all the tools you have you have access to today, are there things that are sort of your go-to type of gear? What do you not go to a set without?
Gosh, the tools that I use just really depend on the project that I'm shooting. It really does vary greatly. I think that, moving from independent film to American TV, to Legion and Strange Angel, and then moving into studio movies, you know, my ability to move the camera has completely shifted, and I've learned about new tools because, you know, working on independent movies, you know, the camera's probably on your shoulder. If it's not on your shoulder, maybe it's on a dolly if you're lucky. Whereas, you know, as soon as I started shooting Legion and the camera was doing acrobats, I, you know, got quickly used to different remote heads, different arms, different remote vehicles, and all kinds of exciting new ways that I hadn't been exposed to before in order to provide camera movement. So I think with the bigger budget productions, that's an exciting thing that's now available, is that we have more choice of how to move the camera to tell the story. But also, you know, lighting wise, you know, usually I'll just base my lighting package on sky panels and Astera tubes, Titan tubes, you know, all these different LED units that are so flexible to use because of low power and sort of low heat. I think I've always been one to shoot my projects with different camera systems. You know, I sort of bounced around a lot depending on the requirements of the job. And also my lens choices, they also, you know, I think that they really are the things that help, you know, shape the look of whatever it is that I'm shooting. So I spend a lot of time doing lens tests before a production will start up.
Well, I mean, lenses are personal. Lenses become very personal. Cameras are cameras. Cameras perform well. You learn the limitations of the cameras, things like that. But you really create a relationship with glass. Is there a particular, like, are you a Panavision person for glass, or your cooks, or your, I mean, I guess it's whatever's right for the story, but like, if you could only pick one piece of glass, that's a rough question, I guess.
It's a hard question because then I would, you know, retort like, are we doing spherical glass? Are we doing anamorphic? And of course, you know, everybody loves Panavision C-series anamorphic lenses. You know, they're so iconic and beautiful, and all the movies that we sort of grow up loving are sort of shot with 35mm with the C-series. But, you know, it's really job dependent, you know, like sometimes minimum focus on an anamorphic lens is just, it's something that isn't going to work for the sort of look that you're going for. So then you shoot spherical, and, you know, I definitely have used a lot of vintage glass. You know, I do love the K35s, the old Canon lenses. Spherically wise, like, I think they are probably my favorite. But you know, nowadays, you know, Panavision and Arri, they can, you know, sort of sit with you and you can talk about a look that you're going for and the different artifacts of different glass that you love, and they can manufacture, you know, lenses that are completely unique to you and to your show. So that is exciting. But, you know, I mean, I do have a great relationship with Panavision. When I was the runner at RSA, I would go hang out with Panavision in my spare time and like label lens cases and make filter labels. And they were always very supportive. They were the company that gave me my free cameras and everything so that I could shoot my first short films. So they've always supported me 100% throughout my career. And you know, I always sort of go to them first.
Good. And a good choice. They're good people. They're just
great
good
people.
You know, I mean, I've dealt with them. You've dealt with them. I've never not walked in there and just felt like I belonged. So yeah. it's you know, all the locations. So yeah. I even worked Panavision Japan.
Oh, wow.
Panavision House in Tokyo. That was different. That was different. It never, everything was so tight. Every shooting alley was, you know, perfectly neat and structured and 2 feet wide. It was just, everything was structured right there, but couldn't be nicer. Same as everywhere. So,
yeah.
All right,
yeah.
So if you had to recommend, I'm not putting this on you, I asked this of all, I guess. Mm-hmm. If you only could watch one movie, which one do you want to watch? And then there's a follow-up question that's actually harder, so go ahead.
In what regard, like, just as sort of example of cinematography that I love, or just a movie that I love?
Just a movie that you love. Just one that you can put on any time and watch it over and over and over again.
I mean, the movies that I love the most are the movies that I grew up watching and the ones that inspired me to do what I do, you know, and an example of that would be, you know, Empire of the Sun.
Mm.
It's a beautiful, beautiful movie and beautiful performances and a heart-wrenching story. And, you know, I mean, I'm not sure I could watch it again and again back to back, but it's definitely a film that stayed with me from childhood.
Okay, now a tougher question. If you could only get somebody to watch one thing that you shot, what one thing do you want them to watch? If they've never seen any Polly Morgan, what film would you put in front of them and say, watch this one? Show, TV show, anything that you, where image-wise you think, this one I want you to see.
You know, it's probably going to be A Quiet Place. Just
that's
because.
Kind of cheating, but okay.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think that. Yeah, it's. I think it's difficult because I'm my own worst critic. I think when I'm. One of my attributes is that I'm always striving to do better at work, and I have been told many, many, many times that I care too much. So, you know, I find it difficult to really see, you know, the good things in my work because I always kind of look at it and think that I could have done better. But, you know, when I look at a film like The Truth About Emmanuel, which was my first, you know, sort of over $1 million independent movie that went to Sundance, you know, I have good regard for that film.
All right. So, yeah, and I loved it too, and I've seen it. But I will tell you, a couple of years ago, I watched Spinning Man, which I didn't know you shot.
Oh.
And I loved that movie. And then the credits came up, and I loved it even more after that. But I had no idea you shot it, and I thought, this looks beautiful. So it was completely non-prejudice. I like Pierce Brosnan. He's in it. It's a kind of film. And everything was great, and it was my kind of storyline, the kind of thing that I just want to pass time with.
Yeah.
And I thought it was fantastic. So that would be, in a weird way, the Polly Morgan I would tell them to watch. Although I'll obviously see Quiet Place. Although Lucy, it might not have been a story that everybody wanted to see the story of, but visually, I thought it was probably your best work. Visually.
Yeah.
It was really pushed all your boundaries because there were things there that just didn't, that loved to hear what she was thinking when she decided to do that. And I'm glad she did it. So,
yeah, I mean, that was definitely you know, I think that movie and A Quiet Place, I had the opportunity to work with two very strong directors who wanted to push the boundaries visually. And, you know, as someone who's just starting out to shoot studio movies, it's exciting to be pushed in that way, you know. But Noah Hawley was somebody, and John also is like this too, where he wanted to move the camera 360. He did not want to wait, wanted to do like acrobats and you know, really just make things really challenging, you know. And I think from a lighting standpoint too, you know, like shooting big wides that then do these beautiful moves that go straight into like a tight close-up, that's very challenging to, you know, create good lighting for, especially when you're trying to light, you know, Natalie Portman or Emily Blunt. So there were definitely, you know, some head-scratching moments, but, you know, and I think even following on from Legion, where that show is so unusual visually, you know, it's such a heady show where it's non-linear and it's just kind of, there are no rules visually, it's all over the place. It's a very exciting place to be as a DP, where you're kind of like always kind of living on the edge a little bit.
Is it different to shoot for an actor director instead of just a director? Did John, we're talking about John Kurencic, right?
Krasinski.
I'm sorry, I butchered his name. Apologize, yeah. Sir. But yeah. Is it different when you're working for an actor director? Do they come at it from a different direction?
Not really. I think, you know, the only tricky thing that it brings with it is time, you know. It's sort of like there's two elements. There's trust and there's time. So, you know, if we do a take and then John walks up and we sort of shake our head and we say, no, that didn't work, he doesn't watch playback, you know, he's just going to go back, he's going to do it again. And then if he comes over and he goes, how is that? You say, we love that one, you know, and then he'll watch it back. And then I'll say, okay, yeah, that was good, but I want to do something different. So it's kind of that trust that the director puts in you to know whether you think you got it, and then the time it takes to watch playback. And obviously, you know, everybody's different. I did The Intervention with Claire Duval, and we never watched playback once. You know, she just put the trust in me and the script supervisor, you know, did we get it or not? And so, you know, I think maybe some actor directors, maybe they want to play back every take, and some don't want to watch it at all. So it really depends on the individual.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on. Appreciate taking time.
You're welcome.
I know the baby's sleeping, so we'll let you go. Congratulations on the baby.
Thank you so much.
God, I hope we get to be in the same room again sometime soon.
That would be lovely.
It really would. 2020 can't end fast enough. So anyway, I really appreciate you coming on, and I hope to see you soon. Thank you, Polly.
Thanks, Dan. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That wraps up our time with Polly. Make sure to watch her newest film, A Quiet Place 2. And I hope you're enjoying the podcast. To make sure you don't miss a thing, please take a second to click the subscribe button so we can keep you up to date on our newest episodes and guests. Seems like we all have a little extra time these days. Do yourself a favor and check out Polly's film, Lucy in the Sky. Wonderfully shot, truly entertaining. I promise you, you will not regret it. So I hope you join me next time on Hollywood, How Did You Get Here?